So tonight I want to talk a little bit about hedonism in a special way, not in the way we ordinarily think of it. And I want to start with a koan from the Hekigan Roku. This is late in the Hekigan Roku. It's koan number 78. And I'm just going to read it to set the tone rather than do a deep dive into the koan. Let me read this koan to you. It's quite interesting. So the title of it is 16 Bodhisattvas Enter the Bath. In ancient times, there were 16 Bodhisattvas who at the monk's bath time, following the rule, filed in to bathe. Suddenly, they experienced realization through the touch of the water. You Zen worthies, how will you understand their saying, quote, experiencing the subtle and clear touch, we have achieved the status of sons of Buddha, end of quote. You will be able to attain to this only after 7 times piercing and 8 times breaking through. That's the koan. So something happened to these monks during a pleasurable immersion in warm water. Now, most people who take a bath don't suddenly come to awakening. And I think that is part of the pointer at the very end of this case. You will be able to attain to this only after 7 times piercing and 8 times breaking through. So I want to talk about that a little bit, this piercing and breaking through. And the role of this practice, this Zen practice, and in particular Zazen, to enter this experience very directly. Now, I've said many times that unlike most religions that we know, Zen is not taken up with meanings or particular goals or rituals that are done in order to obtain some future benefit. And it's also not at all concerned with an afterlife, you know, that this is a suffering place, and if we do certain things and believe certain things and understand certain things and read certain books, that we are more likely to have a happy afterlife. Now, there is traces of that in Buddhism, but it's not the main thrust of Zen practice, at least what we do here. So what we do is a practice called Zazen, and most fundamentally, Zazen is entering your sensations, being your sensations. It's extremely simple. And in many ways it's quite in opposition to how we ordinarily live, which is to have a goal and to hurry through the means in order to get to the end. Particularly if the means to the end is something unpleasant, like work. Not for everybody, but for many people. Or mowing the lawn in order to get a nice, beautiful lawn later on. So we put on headphones and try to ignore the process, the sweaty, noisy, smelly, sticky process of mowing the lawn. So you're kind of getting what I'm pointing at here, is that when we do that, we miss an opportunity to enter, become our sensations. Now, why is this important? And why did I mention the word hedonism? Well, in medical school and also in life, you learn about depression. And what you're taught in medical school and what appears in the DSM-IV manual, which is a manual of psychiatric illnesses, is that there are 2 hallmark features of depression. And they don't have to both be there. And oftentimes only one is there. So you only have to have one or the other, but usually you have both. one of the hallmark features of depression is depression, is a depressed mood. And the other is something called anhedonia. So some people with depression don't have a depressed mood. They don't recognize a depressed mood. Perhaps they're so used to it, they don't think it's anything different or a problem. But in this situation, if you were to diagnose depression and then go about treating depression, you would ask them questions about taking pleasure in ordinary activities. And if they say, you know, I don't get anything out of it. I eat a meal, it doesn't affect me. I go to the movies with friends, I'm not even interested. I don't want to go out, I don't want to do anything, I just want to sleep. So this is what we call anhedonia. And of course, this is a very painful state, and it's so painful, particularly if it goes on for a long time or is very profound, that it's felt that many people who become suicidal suffer in particular from this anhedonia. There's just no point to living. There's no reason to go on. Because the ordinary rewards of momentary interactions with the world and sensory experiences isn't there. So they end up saying, what's the point? Now, just to go into that a little more, when I was a teenager, I became very interested in a philosophy called existentialism, and I've mentioned this before. Existentialism has a very interesting and profound and Zen-like insight. Remember when I said that Zen is not particularly taken up with meaning, but it is very taken up with sensation. So in existentialism, one of the premier philosophies of it, the tenets of it, is that life is absurd. Life has no meaning. Now, why aren't these existentialists happy? Because they are addicted to meaning like everyone is. Somehow there should be meaning to my life. And when I really look closely, I see that any meaning I might give it is quite arbitrary, something I was taught, or some brass ring that I'm reaching for. Hopefully one time around the carousel I'll be able to reach and grab it. But almost always that never happens. So it's a lamenting kind of an observation that life is absurd, the absurdity of existence. Now, an outbranching of existentialism and a kind of development of it was another philosophy called phenomenalism. Or phenomenology, I'm sorry, phenomenology. And the famous philosopher of phenomenology, his name was Martin Heidegger. He was German. Martin Heidegger. It's interesting because near the end of his life, he began reading some writings of D.T. Suzuki. And then stunned way, realized that everything, and he wrote this, and he's told this, and it's a well-known story about Martin Heidegger. He said, everything I was trying to say in my life as a philosopher was really this, was this Zen approach, this Zen viewpoint. So I might say a couple of things about Heidegger's philosophy. Heidegger had this word that he used that was the kind of central point of phenomenology, and it was a word in German that is Dasein, Dasein, D-A-S-E-I-N. Now, I don't speak German, but I think what it means literally, or I know it means being there, but the da is there. It's kind of like a child pointing at things going, da, 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 that, that. And Zion must mean being. And the point of phenomenology is that beyond just the absurdity of things, things are as they are. And the meaning of the world is simply as it is. And Dasein is being there. That you don't simply be, but you are in a place, in a circumstance, with phenomena going on in each moment. You find yourself immersed in a sensory reality. And although I'm not a philosopher and I didn't study Martin Heidegger, this is one aspect of this word that he used all the time, Dasein, being there. Now, once again, he was, like the existentialists, caught up in meaning, trying to decipher what it all meant and trying to move from this awareness of being there into a deeper understanding of the human condition and how to live a happy life, I suppose. What's the point of philosophy if that's not the end result? So he came up with another term, and he called it thrownness. Thrownness. And this word means that through no choice of your own, through no action of your own, you find yourself here. In other words, Dasein is a state of thrownness. You didn't choose to be here. You found yourself here. In this moment, rather than being pure being, you are here as a body sitting on a set of cushions, hearing sounds in a room in Northampton, etc., etc. And there's a despairing quality to this notion of thrownness. It's like, I didn't ask to be alive. It's kind of like the bumper sticker, life sucks and then you die. So where does Zen come in with all this? And in particular, the practice of Zazen, which in my mind is sufficient to describe Zen practice, Zen Buddhism. Zen Buddhism is Zazen. Now it may not be sitting Zazen, but it's the action and the spirit of Zazen. And what is this? Zazen is a recognition of absurdity because you let go of meaning, totally. There's no point to it. There's no place you're trying to get to. If you're doing correct Zazen, you're already there. You're just waking up to it, waking up to it. And you are immersed. It's an immersion. It's a Dasein. It's being there. It's really being there. It's intently being there. So Zazen, properly performed, is not a rote exercise in trying to hold one's mind to an object with the hope that if one does that intensely enough, thoroughly enough, and long enough, eventually some kind of rainbow with unicorns will descend upon one, and one will float up into the sky wearing white robes. Oh no, that's Armageddon. Sorry. Similar. So, Zazen properly done, and this should be right from the start, should be immediately settling into your actual sensations. It's like the master, I think his name was Wei Hai, it was Great Pearl, he said, the entire universe is one bright pearl. One bright pearl. You enter the one bright pearl of the actuality of your current Dasein, exactly as it presents. And yes, let go of meaning. That'll satisfy the existentialists. So when we do this practice, what we're really doing is gradually letting go of our grasp on something we want while pushing away what we don't want. Zazen is not about that. And remember what Sengsan, the third Zen patriarch, said at the very beginning of the verses on the faith mind. He said, the great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. Another translation is, the great way is not difficult, only avoid picking and choosing. Picking and choosing. Whatever it is in this actual moment, whatever Dasein brings in this moment, no thrownness. You immerse in it. You let it be. You totally allow it in the space of your awareness. Now, allowing something in the space of your awareness, you can allow anything. That space is never affected. It's never harmed, it's never glorified, it's never enhanced. You let these things come into the space of your awareness. And that's a kind of hedonic experience. You're entering the actual feeling of your life, the feeling of your body, the feeling of a sound, the feeling of a smell. It's quite hedonic. And it is an antidote to this anhedonia. Anhedonia comes about after wanting gets frustrated enough that one feels there's no point and one has essentially rejected the present moment for the sake of some goal that never seems to arrive, and one finds oneself eventually stressed out, depressed, and anhedonic. And Zazen is the antidote to that. Now, when we really go into this, really profoundly, it is deeply healing. One finds oneself in everyday life letting go of the point of some action and experiencing its actual sensations. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be washing dishes. One starts to leave the notion that, oh, man, there's a sink full, and let's see how fast I can get through this so I can watch the next episode of House or whatever it might be on TV. I think that one's gone, but there are other serials that people really enjoy. But what happens with this practice is one begins to experience the momentary sensations of washing dishes with no goal other than to really do it, really enter it. And out of that attitude, quality is happening. This is quality dishwashing, not quick, rapid, you know, throwaway dishwashing. So this is really the essence of what we're doing. It's entering our sensations and leaving the goal-directed meaning that we so often indulge in our everyday life and then forget about the actuality of each moment's sensation. Now I thought I would read a little bit here, just sort of progressing onward from here. So this is from the book Zen Training, and I forget the name of the author. It may come to me at some point. But this was actually an autobiographical account by a school teacher that I guess he talked to, or that the school teacher wrote, and then he put it in his book. And the school teacher was a Zen student. And just describing this practice. So one might ask, well, what happens as a result of immersion in each sensory moment of this one bright pearl? And how is that related to what is called awakening or enlightenment? So I thought I'd read a little bit of this. I may stop and comment here and there. So a school teacher's experience. I was sitting in the lotus position in a chair in the library upstairs in my school. There were no classes as it was summer vacation. I did not know how long a time had passed, but suddenly and in total darkness, I became aware of myself. Dark! I could not discover where I was. So he's plunged, or she is plunged into darkness, entering so profoundly into one's actuality of being. I could not discover where I was. As in a dream, I was trying to locate myself, and suddenly it became light. I saw that it was a bright day, though I had thought it was the depth of night. And this is an experience that every Zen student, if you do devoted, intent Zazen, that isn't goal-directed but enters your actuality of each sensory moment and notices that in the sensory moment things appear, they appear. In other words, it's not the meaning of a sound, it's the fact, the beingness, the appearance of the sound. Now, the reason I say appearance is that whereas being may be kind of universal, appearance is intimate. So when you go into the intimacy of your experience and you turn back into the intimacy itself, with each sensation being the Dharma door to this place, you can enter a state of what is called samadhi. And every Zen student who does proper Zazen sooner or later should begin to be able to enter this to some extent, maybe not with the profundity here and maybe even more profound. So he said, I thought it had been the depth of night. Now this is interesting what happens. The light came flooding over my shoulders as I was seated with my back to the window. I was not yet sure whether it was morning or afternoon. Perhaps I wanted to know the time. My hand stretched to the watch on the desk and I picked it up. At that moment, I encountered a very strange phenomenon. The watch seemed to be part of me. There was no differentiation between my hand and the watch. Truly an extraordinary feeling. It was quite a different sensation from my ordinary routine one, and it impressed me strongly. I kept looking at the watch for some moments in amazement. So here it is again. He's not looking at the watch to find out what time it is. He's amazed at the experience of having picked up this watch, coming out of a samadhi where the action of thinking has completely ceased, where the action of continually creating a goal, a meaning, a situation, a thrownness, a self standing apart, ceases. And coming out of this, that cessation maintains while sensory input comes in. And suddenly, it's like he's on LSD. He's not interested in what time it is. So he's here. Truly an extraordinary feeling, looking at this watch. It was quite a different sensation than my ordinary routine one, and it impressed me strongly. I kept looking at the watch for some moments in amazement. The watch was its usual shape and gold color. And as far as these qualities were concerned, it was a quite different thing from my hand, which was holding it. Yet in another dimensional quality, it was not different from my hand. So this is another aspect of this immersion, what Weihai called the one bright pearl. The one bright pearl has all sorts of pearlescence, variegation, but it's one thing. One thing. And if one were to say anything about it, one could simply say that it is, it is. When one looks at one's hand, one casually identifies it as one's own. This is done almost unconsciously. A person who is alienated from himself, that is, in a state of depersonalization, and that's a psychiatric state, may find that his hand does not seem part of himself, just as his watch does not seem to be, as we all generally view objects in the world around us. In the present case, the situation was just the opposite. The watch was identified as part of myself. It was this that caused the amazement. The experience was not bewildering, but was deeply impressive. Some moments passed while I looked at the watch, and then I perhaps wanted to ascertain the general situation. I turned my eyes in another direction, and I saw bookshelves standing along the wall. They were several meters from me, but were directly coming into me. What does this phrase, coming into me, mean? It implies that there was no spatial resistance between them and me. Remember now, these monks, through their general ritual of taking a bath, entered the bath water and became sons of the Buddha. In a word, they and I were one. If I am you, you also are me. In the field of vision, they and I are distinct structures, each separately standing in its place. However, just as my own existence is intimate and warm to me, so now are they intimate and warm to me. We are not strangers. Another me is standing there. And this is precisely what we do in our zazen. When we do proper zazen, that is a wholehearted immersion into one's actual sensations. You are doing exactly what he's experiencing. Whether you're aware of it or not, this is exactly what you're doing in your zazen. This phenomenon will perhaps be more easily understood if we recollect certain experiences of our childhood, as, for example, when the Christmas tree with dolls and stars of silver paper and the like stood there as the counterpart of ourselves, just as the mirror reflects our image. So we can all remember in childhood getting very immersed in things. I remember it was time to go to school. It was like a Tuesday. And I kissed my mother goodbye. I was only maybe in the third grade, but you could walk to school back then. People didn't worry so much about kidnapping. They worried about you taking candy from strangers, which I never quite understood at that time. Now I do. So I walked out the door, and my neighbor was also walking to school. He was my best friend at the time, and he and I both discovered on my walk, and I hadn't mentioned to you that my parents had just bought a new refrigerator. Well, there was a refrigerator box on the front lawn. And we decided, we know we had to get to school, but we were just going to play around in this box for a minute or two. Well, literally 2 hours went by. And then we found ourselves being very thirsty and completely having forgotten all about school. We knocked on the door to ask my mother for some juice or something. She said, "What are you doing here? You're supposed to be in school." I never forgot that moment. So anyway, he said, while the structural differentiation of he being he and me being me may be clear, psychologically, no discrimination is felt. In a child's mind, time and space are not yet firmly rooted, as in an adult's, and cognition outside the ordinary framework of consciousness often occurs. So children naturally fall into not so much absolute samadhi, but what we call positive samadhi, immersion. I don't know if you remember as a child going to a movie and being so immersed and having the borders of yourself be so porous to begin with. Then when you left the movie, you felt like you were still in the movie, that you were a character in the movie. And it took many minutes for you to come back down to reality, so to speak. I'm sure you all remember this. Hopefully you do. So he says here, and this is this school teacher, in absolute samadhi, the activity of consciousness is blocked. And when one comes out of it, it takes some time for adult cognition to resume its normal functioning. During the process of recovery, a psychological state comparable to that of a child frequently appears. It is said that a duelist, someone who is in a duel, who had gone through his first duel, found his fingers stuck to the hilt of his sword and had to get someone else to separate his fingers from it, one by one. It's the kind of intensity that one should do shikantaza, for example. Yasutani Roshi, in a short piece on Shikantaza said that you should be like a person in a duel. You have a gun in your hand and you're opposing someone with a gun in their hand. And gradually a crowd forms around you. And you are aware of everything around you, but you never lose focus on the duel. It's this kind of attitude in Shikantaza, this immersion in the present moment that excludes nothing. So then he says, a state of desperation had produced strong mental and physical pressure, and it took some time for it to die away. The same is true of absolute samadhi. So I'm going to just read this one last paragraph. Kensho, which is awakening or satori, is generally accompanied by a sudden and intense feeling of delight. But at this moment of my experience, I felt nothing of the sort. I just kept watching in simple amazement. And I just want to say that awakening, satori, kensho can happen in so many different ways. We tend to read the dramatic descriptions, first-person accounts where profound weeping and the world disappears, and it can be true, but it can appear in other ways as well. Some of it may have to do with the depth, and some of it may have to do with the length of practice and how readily concepts come back. But he says here, I felt nothing of the source. I just kept watching in simple amazement. The wall, the windows, the floor, and once again the shelves and books, they were changed. They seemed just about to jump from their places to meet me, and at the same time remain motionless, hush and silent. The film suddenly stopped, and the picture on the screen remained fixed but alive. It was a breathtaking continuum of the present. So, hopefully I was able to convey to you what this practice is really about, which is entering your experience, not understanding it, not figuring it out, not achieving some future goal, but profoundly, intently entering the sensations of each moment, not only on the cushion, but in your everyday life. And this is the antidote to anhedonia. And this is what will rescue existentialists from the despair of absurdity. So I think we've reached the end of our time, and we'll end there.